The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this morning I would like to talk about the Buddhist practice of refuge. It's a very important part of traditional Buddhism, is that people who feel connected to the Dharma, to the Buddha, to the Sangha, will do something that's called going for refuge, or literally the word is walking for refuge, and entering into this place that's safe, where we're one of the things that it said we're safe from, and that kind of is kind of overcome when we go for refuge, is fear. And so this powerful movement of going for refuge, which is closely connected to the Buddhist idea of faith, or it might not be the best word in English, it translates sadha, but to be the place where we put our heart on, or the place where we put ourselves on our heart, kind of the placing ourselves in our heart, in our heartfelt place, and it's a place that we become safe. Sometimes the idea of refuge is called the triple refuge. The refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha is called the triple jewels. And the word is ratana, and it's a jewel because it's a treasure, it's quite precious, and also because it brings delight. And the word for delight is rati, and ratana, rati. I don't know if it's a real etymology, but Buddhists will shamelessly use anything for etymology. And so the idea of refuge. I also thought of it today, given how so many people in our society feel challenged with the post-election, with what's going on, and all kinds of ways. And so the idea of refuge is meant to be also refuge from the challenges of our wider world that we live in, some place that we can be sheltered, be supported. But it's not meant to be a place where we hide, but rather a place that, rather than being bounded by a place of shelter, our heart becomes sheltered so that we can carry ourselves forward into the world everywhere we go. It's not meant to be a withdrawal from the world to go for refuge, but it's meant to be a way of being in the world, an orientation that guides us and supports us, and a certain kind of way gives orientation to a world which is often chaotic and difficult to be in, challenges of our life. In thinking about it today, I remember the story from the time of the Buddha of a king who had a conversation with the Buddha, came to see the Buddha, and his king was apparently somewhat one of the kings of the time, the person who was closest to the Buddha. His name was Pasenadi. And some of the suttas describe him as being a little bit living an indulgent life. At some point, the Buddha gave him advice about how to lose weight. And so he comes to see the Buddha, and the Buddha asks him, how are you? And the king says, oh, I'm really busy. I'm busy conquering neighboring countries and indulging in lots of sensual pleasures. And so the Buddha then gives him a little teaching, and maybe the teaching has to do with the context in which this conversation is going and who he's talking to. But he says to the king, imagine that one of your ministers, agents, one of your people is comes from the east saying, these huge cloud-high mountains are rolling from the east towards you, destroying everything in its path. And there's sharp cliffs, just walls of mountain coming. And someone else comes from the south and tells you there's mountains coming, rolling, destroying everything on its path towards you. And from the west and from the east, from the north. So, you know, these huge, huge mountains are coming, bearing down. Remember, Buddha lived close to the Himalayas, so, you know, the size of mountains were big. And so this is like, you know, you don't just put up a little your arm and stop the mountains usually. I mean, this was going to be serious. And so the Buddha asked him, what would you do? And it's, you know, hopeless to save your life. You know, you're going to be crushed. And so the king says, oh, if that was happening, I would live the Dharma. And so quite an evocative statement also for the king to say, I would live the Dharma. So in the last moments you have before the mountains finally crush you, would you still live the Dharma? What would you do? And then the Buddha goes on to say, well, actually, old age and death is rolling towards you from all directions. It's going to come and get you at some point. And, you know, don't forget this. And so this idea of even in the context of these great existential issues of our life that all of us have to face, all of us have to live with, old age and death. Some people avoid it and don't think about it. Some people, it's very close to them. They understand it all too well. Is Dharma relevant? Is it something that makes sense to live the Dharma? Does it make sense to take refuge in the Dharma in the context of these great dangers that our lives live in? So in thinking about these walls of mountains coming towards us, I remembered that I've kind of reviewed the year, this last year for myself, different situations I was in where somehow I was reminded of walls that people live in and what's going on. And the first one that came to mind was a friend of mine who died this year of cancer. And she'd been kind of dealing with this for many years. Finally became clear that she was going to die. And last time I talked to her on the phone was, I think, a day or so before she admitted herself to hospice. She lived alone. And so I talked to her on the phone, and she told me what she was going to do. And I'd never known her more happy. In fact, I would say that it was probably among the top five happy conversations of my life, the fact that she was going into hospice. And she was resolved and clear and at ease and kind of, you know, let go, and this is what was happening. She was accepting it. And then I went to see her maybe a week or 10 days later in hospice. And what struck me was how small her room was. The walls had come closer. And it was a lovely hospice in the Castro District in San Francisco. And the rooms were relatively small, smaller than the rooms at IRC. And though she was laying in bed, and I don't think she really even noticed the walls. But for me, it kind of clear, oh, the whole life, this is the end of her life. She moved into this room. And this was going to last door she was going to go through, last room she was going to be in. And so I visited her twice there, and each time she was less capable of having conversation. The second time I went, last time I went, I think was her last day of her life. It wasn't clear that she could even hear what was going on, but she was, at times, she was kind of restless, a little bit distressed. And so I chanted the refuges for her. And as long as I chanted the refuges for her, she would relax and her body would come. Oh, she can hear. And that was, you know, that she would relax and be peaceful for a while, and that I'd do it again. And it was quite lovely. I left, and then I guess she died later that evening. And I think people who were there said that they claimed it made a big difference that she did the refuges with her. So that came to mind, this, you know, life, you know, end of life, The walls come in, the walls come in. I thought of the fire in Oakland, the walls that kept people in the fire, and 36 people died. We never know when it's going to happen. The aging and death comes in, rolls in. Did they take refuge? What would they do? What would you do when it seems like there's no way out? I thought about going to St. Anthony's Kitchen in San Francisco. St. Anthony is a kind of a soup kitchen that offers meals to people in the Tenderloin in San Francisco. And I think they offer some, like a couple of thousand meals a day. And so kind of run by volunteers, the whole big crew of volunteers. It's a well-oiled system. And people come in and they're offered trays of food and they go out. And the first shift that comes in is are the elderly. And so I went with the chaplains that were training here at IMC, and also with my 18-year-old son. I wanted to show him a little bit of that part of the world. And so our job was to take the trays of food, and the people receiving the food were sitting at tables in a big dining area. And we'd go carry the food to the tables and put it down in front of them and offer it to them and have a little conversation. And then we would go get more trays, and if they wanted more food, they could just raise their hand and they can get more, much as they wanted. And many of them brought with them little containers, and they would take the food with them, take home. And again, there's the walls. You know, the walls were quite expansive, but it's still inside this place. How it comes to this. And it struck me that when I was there, and I don't know if my thinking was very accurate or appropriate even, but this is how I thought and therefore how I felt in my heart, was many of the people came, many of the elderly who came, were certainly very poor, but they had lives, as far as I could tell, that were not consciously connected to the great events of our society and the world around them. They weren't thinking about the election back then. This was back in May. They weren't thinking about what goes on in Iraq or Syria, or they weren't thinking about what goes on across the bay. Or it seemed like they were just trying to cope. They were just trying to survive. And it was very clear that their life was very close in to survival issues. And there was a whole table lined up with people who were in wheelchairs, because there was lots of room behind those tables, so they could come up. And so there, in, you know, a life bounded by poverty, bounded by disability, bounded by, you know, held, aging and death, disability comes in and holds us, makes our world kind of small, perhaps, or something. And that can happen to any of us. And so is refuge, going for refuge, relevant? Is it something that brings delight? Can it bring delight for you, those of you in the knowing, those of you who know about the Dharma? Can it be a source of delight in times of great challenge, or times when things get close in, the walls come in for you? I thought about also going this year to San Quentin, also with my 18-year-old son, to show him that part of the world, also with the chaplains that were training. And being in a room, and again, the room was kind of, as you know, the kind of the space and the walls. Now there was a low ceiling, this place, because it was a modular building, kind of these trailers put together, right, in the yard in San Quentin. They had it into a classroom. In San Quentin, many places of it is a really tough place. And some places just feel so hostile in all directions. You go into some of these places where the prisoners are and the guards are, and just kind of, it's hard to believe that we put people in places that feels like dungeons. But this classroom is like, I don't know if they would say that, but for me, I've been there now a number of times, kind of sacred space, very special. Because here's a place where, among other things, there's a group of about 30 prisoners of different races, and here's a place for that's safe for the different races to become friends with each other. It's not safe in San Quentin outside of in the yard or in everywhere else. They keep themselves very segregated, and it's kind of unsafe to integrate themselves. But there, they become friends, and there they're doing deep work based on mindfulness practice, but a lot of other approaches to really have them look deeply at their deep pain, their hurt, their violence, what they've done in the world. So we sat there with a room of almost 30 people, most of them who had murdered someone. And they'd gone through this incredible deep program of healing, of opening their hearts, of love, honesty, of looking at themselves, all in this room, you know, this bounded room, this place of safety. You create a place of safety, you create a place where people can really look at themselves and be with them. And it's a place where I felt it was safe to bring an 18-year-old son. It's not that often you can bring your 18-year-old to a room full of murderers and feel safe. And more than just safe, but I felt the I tried a little bit to raise him with some of these wisdom ideas that I have from Buddhism and my practice. I have no idea what impact it had, because especially when he was a teenager, there were other kind of walls. But we went there to that, you know, modular room with these men in San Quentin. And he sat among them and talked with them, and the things that he heard, things talked about, were kind of like a dream come true for me as a father, hearing wisdom, hearing about practice, hearing what can happen, how people can be transformed. It was, you know, so wow, just in time before he left home. So all these, you know, safety, walls, boundaries. You know, where do we find ourselves in this world of challenges? And now we have many people in our society now, too many people, feels like the walls are closing in on them. They're worried about it. A lot of immigrants, a lot of people here as illegal immigrants are really, really afraid, because the immigration service, the border customs, people are going to come and take them soon. That's what they think. That's what they've been told is going to happen. And they're afraid. The walls are closing in. The amount of hostility and hate and racism that's reared its head in this country has frightened a lot of people who for a long time have felt the impact of it, but now feel it's almost stronger, and kind of like they don't feel like they can go out. It was this year, right, when we had here at Sunday a imam come and speak here, a Muslim cleric. And he was a cleric in San Jose. And he said that in San Jose, that as a Muslim, he doesn't want to go to certain places in public, like the gas stations, at night, because he doesn't feel safe at night to go in a place like that. So the walls come in. The walls are closer. So we live in a world. So where do we find our safety? Where do we find our inspiration? What brings us joy and gladness? And that's the function of refuge, the refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And the formula that people chant, Buddhists chant, is I walk for refuge, I go for refuge. It literally says I walk for refuge to the Buddha. I walk for refuge to the Dharma. I walk for refuge to the Sangha. I love the idea of walking rather than saying go, because go is a little bit abstract, but walk means you bring all of yourself along. You don't hold yourself back. Everything is involved and included. And the word for going, walking, in this ancient language also means to understand, to know something. So to go for refuge means to understand the refuge, to understand the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. So it's something, hopefully something inside of us that resonates with what the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha represent for us, it speaks to something in our heart. We see ourselves in those things. So they're not something external so much as a resonance with what we already have. And It said that there are three aspects of going for refuge, of this understanding. It's kind of an orientation. Well, it's an orientation. So there's understanding, and there's also intentionality. It's the intentions we have, what motivates us. So going for refuge is not a passive movement. It's not a movement of, you know, going someplace and being safe and not acting. But going for refuge is a decision, an intention about how to live a life. What we understand, how we orient ourselves, and also it's what we're devoted to. And the idea of faith. And the idea of devotion is a beautiful word, beautiful concept. Maybe difficult for some people to relate to because of their associations they have with the word. But, you know, what we're willing to do with our whole heart. You know, that which we feel is worthwhile and meaningful to enter into wholeheartedly. And this, you know, willing to give ourselves over as an act of devotion or dedication. And so what is it that about the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha that brings joy? What is it that brings safety? What is it that is something that we can feel devoted to? What is it about it? What's going on? Part of the clue, I think, is that sometimes in Theravada Buddhism, they talk about a fourth refuge that you take refuge in as well, besides the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And the fourth refuge is yourself. Because it's you that have to do the walking. It's an intentional act. You're important, and you're valuable. And so this is something we do. We take refuge in our ability to respond in a certain way. We take refuge in our ability to live a life that's wise. We take refuge in our capacity to be free, to be our capacity not to be caught by fear, not to be caught by hate, not to be caught by distress and, you know, a spinning mind. And so, you know, refuge points back to ourselves. And it isn't something we just rely on that which is out there. They're going to take care of us now. The Buddha Dharma are going to take care of us. If I take refuge and relax, you know, I'll be taken care of. There's a reciprocal mutual relationship between the refuges and oneself. And when the more we take refuge in ourselves, the more it makes sense to take refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha. Because in taking refuge in ourselves, what it means is we learn how to be at home in ourselves. We learn how to be settled, relaxed. We learn how to take care of ourselves. We learn how not to rely on something else, someone else, to take care of us or to make us happy and safe. We learn not to take refuge in money, in jobs, in relationships, in governments, in homes. You know, there's all these refuge places people go for refuge, which are not really refuges. And I've told the story many times that how when I was in Burma, I was there on an 8-month retreat. So I wasn't out and about, but I had a little bit of the Burmese money, the kyat, but not a lot, that I just had there for just in case something happened. So I woke up one morning and I was told that most of the denominations of paper money in Burma had been made invalid by the government overnight. Well, you know, well, at least in America it says, in God we trust, so, you know, I thought, you know, that was like, and I know a lot of things you can't trust in the world, but I thought currency, this is my delusion. And that was quite impressive. And I just read recently that they did a similar thing in India. A lot of people in India keep their money, don't trust the banks or the system, or they don't want to pay taxes, so they keep a lot of low denomination bills at home, like, you know, suitcases of them. And so the government basically, they did a little more sophisticated than what Burma did. There was kind of a way of, if you pay your taxes, you can turn all the money into the banks by January 1st. But that's quite something, you know. You trust, you know, suddenly your money is like, what? So the idea that we don't think we take refuge in these things, but there's a way in which we trust or we rely on things which maybe don't ultimately offer are not reliable. And so if we don't rely on them 100%, if we don't, our happiness is not dependent on them, the idea of refuge is to find happiness, find well-being, find peace, find safety in something which is reliable. And that which is reliable has to do with what's in our hearts, in our minds. That's ultimately, in the face of old age and death, the face of your death coming along, you know, you're not going to, hopefully you're not going to find your happiness in the last minutes of your life because of your bank account or the house you're in, because you might be in a small room in a hospice. Who knows what you're going to have then? Are you able to find happiness in yourself? Have you discovered what that is, where that is for yourself? And so so to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha is to understand that those, the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha represents something in yourself, a capacity. And you're not, Buddhists are not required to go for refuge and do it, but there's often a strong tendency for people to want to do it at some point when they begin recognizing that what they're taking refuge in is already in them, is an understanding, a capacity, a direction, a way of being. It's said that when a person has gone for refuge, or really understands refuge, they have no reason anymore to ever complain. Isn't that powerful? That's a powerful statement. You can say that things are not going well in the world without complaining. But you know, it doesn't mean you can turn your blind eye and say nothing's, you know, everything's, you know, rosy and nice. But the idea that we're no longer complaining, no more. The first person I read who wrote about this idea, didn't say complaining. He wrote, "You can't rile against the world." And so I don't know how you hear the idea of no longer complaining, but. Maybe you first think about some of the people around you who complain. It would be nice if they went for refuge. And then you might understand that maybe it's relevant for you too. Because complaining means there's something about the act of complaining that is giving away our power, giving away our freedom. It's a little bit like giving up something. And saying the problem's out there and someone should do something. Something's wrong out there. And of course, there's a lot of things wrong out there. But our peace, our well-being, our happiness shouldn't be dependent on what's out there. It's possible to discover it here within. So the second of the refuges is maybe in some ways the most important one for most people. And that is the Dharma. And the Dharma is... The word has many meanings, but in the context of the refuges, it refers to that which is liberating. And there's three things that are liberating. There are teachings which point to liberation. There are practices that point to liberation. And there are realizations of liberation. And all those three things, the teachings, the practices, and the realizations, are all called the Dharma. And down through the centuries, the teaching that encapsulates all three, that symbolizes all three, is the Four Noble Truths. And the Buddha said that those are reliable refuges, the Four Noble Truths. That somehow, if we can understand how when we crave or cling or tighten up or contract in our hearts and our minds, how that gives birth to suffering, to distress, to anxiety, to misery, to stress. If we can really understand that for ourselves, what the mechanism, what the movement is within ourselves of how that works, and then know that when you recognize that craving or that contraction that we have, we recognize it's possible to release it and live without it, then we've discovered the Four Noble Truths. And we've discovered a powerful thing within us, a refuge within ourselves. It means that, in theory, then you can go in any place at all And if you start contracting, if you start getting afraid, if you start getting angry, it's possible to turn the attention to your own heart, see what you're doing, and release the forces of fear and anger and greed and these things. It's possible to relax and open up. And to do so, it makes you safer rather than less safe. Some people don't want to give up their hate and their anger and their fear because they feel they can be less safe if they give it up. But the idea is you're actually safer without it. You're more protected without it. So the Four Noble Truths is the mindfulness practice of looking deeply into ourselves, being still and watching, and no longer spinning outwards, centrifugal force, outward, looking outside for the solution, looking outside for where to blame, looking outside for any place but within ourselves. But to turn, have the ability to, to turn around and really discover the possibility of freedom and happiness within. And it's a beautiful thing to do that. It's a fantastic thing to have them have that teaching that points to that direction. It's kind of like a shorthand to happiness, because the long route to happiness that is very unreliable is to rearrange the world to be just right. And you know, and some people spend a lot of years rearranging things, just getting everything all lined up. I remember one woman I knew here, this local woman who worked hard for many years, was all lined up, to all depended on stock options, and then the company tanked, and then the stock papers became toilet paper for her. Mm-hmm. Maybe toilet paper was more valuable because maybe it worked better than what the paper that she had. So, you know, rearranging the world or rearranging your heart. And if we can rearrange our heart, then we know something deep about freedom, about love, about peace, which is one of the most important offerings we can offer to others. Someone has to know how to be at peace in this world, not to be kind of all caught up in anxiety and running around like a chicken without its head. Someone has to know this deep abiding possibility of freedom and kind of and show it to other people. And that's what the Buddha was. So we take refuge in the Buddha, we take refuge as an example of someone who has done this, who's lived this way, who could look a king right in the face and say, you know, the mountains are coming. So it's said that sometimes when we take refuge in the Buddha, we take a refuge in his example. A powerful example. And it's very inspiring for some people. It's very, to know that it's, to have an example for some people makes it possible to do for themselves or inspiring to do for themselves. Maybe it's a little bit like the 4-minute mile. In the 1950s, it was said no one could break the 4-minute mile. Then someone did. And after that, many, I don't know if many is the right word, but lots, you know, relatively many, did it. So the Buddha did this 4-minute freedom thing, you know, showed it's possible. And then many people have done it after that. And so the refuge in the Sangha is take refuge in the community of people who are orienting their lives around the teachings, orienting life around the practices, and orienting their life around the realizations that come from doing those practices. They orient life around the Dharma. And it's very helpful to have those other people who are doing this and to be in communities of supportive people, kind people, good people who you know, show it's possible. I know that 100% that I could not have practiced as much as I did without the community of people around me, without people who supported me, without teachers who mirrored the practice for me, who encouraged me, from other practitioners. I feel, you know, I feel like in some ways who I've become is in part because of being in the communities I've been in for 40 years and inspired by them, informed by them, guided by them. It's a wonderful thing. The Buddha But so as we begin deepening the practice, and the third part of Dharma becomes real for us, the realization of the Dharma, the realization of freedom, of the truth, then we understand that when we take refuge in the Buddha, we don't take refuge in the Buddha as the example anymore, but we take refuge in the Buddha's Bodhi. And Bodhi means awakening. And it's very explicit in this tradition of ours that as the practice deepens, the place to put refuge is not in the Buddha, but in the Buddha's awakening, in the experience of release, the experience of waking up, the experience of freedom that the Buddha experienced, because it's ours as well. And at first we have hints of it. At first we have small tastes of it. We drop into that some kind of greater freedom than, you know, in small ways. And then over time, it's something we grow in. But it's helpful to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, because even though you might have a little taste of it, life is challenging. It's full of challenges. And it's not easy to really find our peace, our freedom, as the mountains roll in, the walls come in, whatever the walls in that you're struggling with or dealing with. It's not easy to live this life, this human life. And so we might be able to go and touch freedom sometimes. Not a few people will go to meditation retreats and feel to touch something very precious, very valuable, that they've never known before. Something deep, something opening, some deeper intimacy and at-homeness that they've ever experienced. And felt, this is great. And then leave the retreat, and a day later, it's like, what happened? Where is it? And feel discouraged and feel like, well, it's not worth it. If I could only have it on retreat, it's not worth it. It has no meaning. But what the retreat does is shows a possibility that then, after that, we can take refuge or be inspired by the Buddha or Sangha. Is it is possible to live this way? That's the direction I'm going. That's my choice. That's where I'm going to align myself. That's what I want my life to be about. And and it doesn't matter how far I get in this lifetime. This is a beautiful and important and valuable and purposeful life to live, the life of kind of developing and growing this freedom, this compassion, this liberation, this awakening, more and more into my life. And so the idea of going for refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha is also to live a purposeful life, a life that now is understood. It's not chaotic. It's not without meaning. It's not without purpose. It's not without guidance. But it's very clear what it's about. And some people who do this going for refuge do it such a way that the Dharma becomes central in their life. This movement of liberation, of freedom, the movement of heart becomes the purpose of their life. And so I'll end with, I studied with a Zen teacher for a while named Robert Aitken Rushi. And he was kind of like the grandfather of American Zen. Wonderful man. And he had started to notice that many of his students would come to him and said, I want to learn how to integrate the practice into my life. And many people, they go on retreat, they start discovering, they say, yeah, this is great being on retreat, it's great to do this practice, but I want to apply it to my life and integrate it in my life. It's a beautiful sentiment, it's a great motivation. But then he said, there's another option. Rather than integrating your practice into your life, why don't you integrate your life into your practice? So when we go for refuge, it's like the practice or the Dharma becomes the center. And then everything else orients around that or is guided by that. That's an option. And I think that if, as we settle in the practice and discover the refuge inside, that becomes, in fact, what happens. That everything then is related to our freedom. Everything then is associated to the possibility of practicing to become free. And in doing so, we hopefully become a contribution, a benefit to our wider society, because our society needs us. And I hope that people who go for refuge in turn become a refuge for others. So may each of you find a refuge that can be your, whether it's Buddhist refuge or something else, that the refuge that can be the reliable support, reliable place of safety that can help you as the walls come bearing down. Thank you all.